Our reading today comes from one of my favorite books, The Secret Life of Bees by Sue Monk Kidd. The Secret Life of Bees is a novel about an adolescent white girl's search for freedom from the abuse that she suffered in her upbringing. And her name is Lily. And the story takes place in South Carolina in 1964. After fleeing her abusive father, she finds shelter in a family of African-Americans with a beekeeper named August. And August leads a community gathered around a statue of the Virgin Mary that's been passed down from the time of slavery. And they call this icon of the Virgin Our Lady of Chains because she's broken the chains of bondage. And in this passage, Lily describes a conversation about Our Lady of Chains that she's having with August. I took my other hand and I placed it on top of hers, and she moved her free hand on top of it. So we had this black and white stack of hands resting on my chest. When you're unsure of yourself, August said, when you start pulling back into doubt and small living, she's the one that's inside you saying, get up from there and live like that glorious girl that you are. She's the power inside you. You understand? Her hands stayed where they were, but released their pressure. And whatever it is that keeps widening your heart, that's Mary too. Not only the power inside of you, but the love. And when you get down to it, Lily, that's the only purpose grand enough for a human life. Not just to love, but to persist in love.
When I think about the concept of love in 2011 in the United States, the word that comes to mind for me is schlocky. It's a good word. It's actually a real word, too. It comes from Yiddish, like a lot of good words, and it means cheap, trashy, junky. We have rendered this beautiful concept of love schlocky in our society by cavalierly treating it in such a sentimental, shallow, and superficially sexualized way. Even Christianity has contributed to this word becoming schlocky, in my view, in spite of this idea going back to the beginning of Christianity that God is love. As the process theologian Catherine Keller puts it, the concept of Christian love conjures up for many a picture of a Victorian Jesus with flowing auburn locks and moist eyes, turning a cheek in a manner suggestive not of daring, but of victimization. Yuck. The modern schlockiness of love, and I did make that up, but the modern schlockiness of love is why I sometimes have avoided talking about it in sermons. And it may be partly why, if you look at our seven UU principles, you will not find the word love in there. Over the years, I've caught some flack from some of you about not preaching enough about love. And a few years ago, I concluded that the flack was probably justified. So I have set out to redeem the word for me anyway, and maybe a few of you. And so this today is not the first whack I've taken at love in a sermon in the last few years. Last year, I approached love through the lens of Greek mythology. The Greeks delved deeply into love, as they did with many things, through using metaphor. They even pictured one form of love, Eros, as a god. This Greek stroke of genius suggests an approach to redeeming love that I find helpful, namely using God as a metaphor for love. And for me, this is not a stretch. I grew up hearing the scripture that Karen used at the beginning of the service, God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in thee. To me, that may be the summation of the message that Jesus brought. So this view, which makes sense to me, is one that is very central to much of process theology. And so while I continue to find God to be a useful metaphor for love, my excursion into process theology this month has reminded me also of the limits of metaphor. Yes, many process theologians see God as an evocative metaphor for love, but God is also more than a metaphor for process theology. God names something actual, although it's ethereal, an actual presence alive and afoot in the world, as Rebecca Parker, a UU theologian, puts it. And I think what God refers to in process theology can be summed up in that, those two words I used last week, the call forward. That unforeseen force from deep in the realm of mystery that beckons us forward to live lives that are more whole and full and ethical. And I use the word unforeseen force because it's a force that does not coerce, but a force that coaxes, cajoles, tries to gently nudge us forward. God, in my view, is what persistently nudges us to step the next step with integrity, with trust, with hope, as we walk into the very next moment of our lives. In my own life, it's the mysterious but real force that called me forward into the ministry, that called me forward to do the ministry here for these past 20 years. It's the force 25 years ago that gently encouraged me to move from unhealthy relationships into healthier relationships, including with the person that turned out to be my life partner. It's the force that beckons me forward in the work here of building an inclusive and diverse community, both within these walls and in the wider community. And it feels like these calls forward for me have come from both the outside and within, maybe actually more from within. And I think, for me, God is a pretty good name for these calls forward, whether they're outside or inward. Love is another name for them, as long as we're not using love in that kind of schlocky way. A powerful way for me to think about the call forward is to see it as a persistent question asked over and over again. As I take this next step, what can I do to actualize love? That's the question I want to keep asking myself. And as I ask that question, I find role models to be helpful in answering it. What would Jesus do actually is a good question. What would Jesus do if Jesus were walking in my shoes about to take this next step? What would Olympia Brown, the great universalist minister that I idolize, what would she do if she were walking in my shoes and about to take this next step? What would the Buddha do? Let's go a little further with this idea of love or God as the call forward by going back to the Greeks, back to their understanding of love. The Greeks had a deeper view of love, partly because they saw it as coming in several different forms. They didn't just have this one-size-fits-all word for it. So one of the forms of love that the Greeks recognized and talked a lot about was Eros. Eros, the god of the same name, Eros, which is passionate, embodied, fiery, palpable. It has a huge heaping of desire in it. Eros is most often experienced by us in the love that's an intimate physical relationship with a lover, but there's many other ways in which it can also be experienced as long as it has that passion, that fieriness, that palpable sense to it. And I think that Eros is really present in compelling calls forward. Contrary to that moist-eyed Victorian picture of Jesus as the hapless victim, I think it was really passion that compelled Jesus in the stories we have about him to step forward in spite of the obvious risk to himself and his followers. He did not have to step forward in front of a mob of men holding rocks about to stone the woman accused of adultery. That actually was not a very smart thing for him to do, right? Why did he do it? He did it because he passionately believed in the message he was preaching. He passionately believed that the world needed to be a more just and peaceful place, beginning with this next moment of this woman not being stoned to death. Without that burning passion, I think he would have just stood there passively watching as this woman was stoned to death. A similar passion burned in Gandhi and in Martin Luther King Jr. as they walked forward up to people with guns and batons and ferocious dogs and fire hoses. It's that passion that compelled them to step forward. And not only to step forward, but to keep stepping forward, to persist in it, to do the work they did day after day, month after month, year after year. This kind of passionate love embodied by King and Gandhi, of course, is not easy, also not boring. A good word for it is it's an adventure. And I like to think of it as an amorous adventure, an adventure of love. I want to share another less dramatic, less well-known example of someone heeding a passionate call forward. The someone is my father. When I was little, my father quit an unfulfilling, complicated job in a family business, but a lucrative job. After years of painful discernment, the call forward he felt within was the call to make music. So he quit this lucrative job, and he took a job, part-time job, as a junior high choir director. In 1963 or 64, that was certainly not a conventional thing to do. He had a stay-at-home wife, five kids, and he left a lucrative job. Why? Well, a huge reason why was the passion he felt for music. He had an unquenchable desire to make music, and even more to help kids learn how to make music. Without that burning passion for music, he never would have made that difficult, unconventional choice. One more story, the story of someone you probably have not heard of, Vedran Smailovic. His story I like because it kind of combines Gandhi and King and my dad. Vedran Smailovic was a professional cellist who lived in Sarajevo during the Bosnian Civil War. In fact, he witnessed outside his window that notorious shelling of the bread line in which 22 innocent civilians were killed standing in line to get bread. Well, he felt this call forward the next day from within as he struggled to know what to do. And he went out that next day. He put on his concert attire. He brought his cello. He went out to that very spot where that mortar shell landed. And he played the haunting and beautiful Adagio by Albinoni. And then he played that every day for 22 days, each day in honor of one of those people slain in that attack. The Indian writer Swati Chopra writes, "He played to ruined homes, smoldering fires, scared people hiding in basements. He played for human dignity, that is the first casualty of war. Ultimately, he played for life, for peace, for the possibility of hope that exists even in the darkest hour." Asked by a journalist whether he was not crazy doing what he was doing, Smailovic replied, "You ask me if I am crazy for playing the cello. Why do you not ask if they are not crazy for shelling Sarajevo?" But love is more than passion. So we need to fill out the picture. And the Greeks help here, too. They viewed another form of love as agape. That's what they called it. A more generalized love than eros. A love that's characterized by being charitable and unconditional. It's a wide love, encompassing not just a beloved partner or family and friends, but people you don't know, even enemies. Agape is part of what pushed Jesus to step in front of that crowd ready to stone the woman, because he recognized in some way that he was related to her. Agape widens love. beyond those we know. So a little story to illustrate. And this is a story of someone in the end who could not find within himself agape. I met a man a few years ago who was very passionate about the partner church movement in the UU Association. And I had the impression that mostly his life had been cold and unhappy and disconnected. But in a partnership that his church had with another Unitarian congregation internationally, he found in that a sense of connectedness. He found a passion for the people in the partner church. He would have done anything for them. He did a lot for them. I think he would have stepped in front of a mob to save their lives if he could. And yet, in his own church and in his own town, he still remained unhappy and disconnected and cold. Eros called him forward into this partner church relationship, but he was not able to widen it. He was not able to take that passionate love and then make it into agape. What a shame. What a shame. And I know it doesn't have to go that way, because there's people in our own congregation who have had that partner church experience and very much then translated it into a wider love. It seems to me that deep love, the kind that saves the world, that is a combination of eros and agape. It needs the depth of passion and the width of agape. And when those two join, then you have the possibility of justice. Love makes justice matter. It makes it matter when you put those two together, that the family down the street that you don't even know is facing foreclosure. It makes it matter that someone on the other side of the world that you don't know does not have enough food today. When those two, eros and agape, get integrated in the soul, then we're able to do the work of building a better world. Catherine Keller, the process theologian, has a clever way of capturing all this in one word. So she takes the word compassion, and she sticks a forward slash in it between the first syllable and the last two. So compassion, come/passion. And when you look at that in the printed word, the passion jumps out at you, and you realize passion's part of compassion. You need to feel that fiery passion to be compassionate. And the first syllable, come, means with. So literally, passion with the other. A combination of both eros and agape. To me, this was the kind of love symbolized by the Our Lady of Chains Mary icon in the passage that Karen shared. August tells Lily, as we heard, when you're unsure of yourself, when you start pulling back into doubt and small living, Mary is the one inside of you saying, get up from there and live like the glorious girl you are. When you live in doubt and small living, boy, have I been there. I bet many of you have too. This is the voice within saying, get up. Live like the glorious person you are. Such power in that. That's the call forward. And then, what is the call forward telling Lily to do? August answers, to keep widening your heart, to keep widening your love, not only the power inside of you, but the love. And when you get down to it, Lily, she says, that's the only purpose grand enough for a human life. Not just to love, but to persist in love. So the call forward is about widening your love and then sticking with it. And when you do all that, when you combine eros and agape, you don't have schlocky love. You have the kind of love that can save the world. There's another piece of wisdom from The Secret Lives of Bees that I want to lift up. That Lily hears this call forward when she finds herself in community. She could not hear it when she was really alone, disconnected, her mom's dead, her dad's abusive. But then she runs away and she joins this group of beekeepers. And then she can feel that love and the power that's been in her all along. But then she could feel it. Community helps us feel love. It helps us feel God. It helps us hear the call forward. No one understood this better than Martin Luther King Jr., who wrote a lot about the beloved community. He knew that love creates beloved community, and beloved community creates more love. That a secret to this equation is being in a beloved community. Dottie and I thought about this past few weeks. She shared that in both the Wellspring Wednesday discussions here in Oshkosh about God, community came up within about 2 minutes. Isn't that interesting? So we UUs are talking about God, and before we know it, we're talking about communion, about community. There's so much truth in that connection because God and love and community are all connected. Many of us are in this beloved community because here, like Lily with the beekeepers, we can find and feel that power and that love within us. And then in this community, we can figure out how to best move forward to help that love become actualized. God, love, the call forward, these are all intermixed in a beloved community. That's why many of us care about this place, why we come. It means something more than a bowling league or our workplace or, for some of us, even our families. Love is a fragile thing. It needs nurturing, and the beloved community can help us nurture it. Rebecca Parker has an image of God that I like a lot. She pictures God as this fragile new shoot of green life coming up from the earth. It's hardy, it's persistent, but it's very fragile and delicate. A picture for God that I have is a picture this blossoming columbine I saw last summer hiking along a hillside in Colorado. No other columbines around, and there's this one, and it's coming out of through a little pine tree, so you almost couldn't see it. But there it is, this beautiful blossom in the middle of this pine tree in the middle of this hill. I love that as an image of God. It says a lot more to me than a picture of God as this macho guy up in the sky with a lightning bolt about to zap me. Or in the Far Side version of that, God sitting at a computer about to hit the smite key. I much rather picture God as a flower. So I want to end with one last image of God that I think beautifully captures what process theology is about. This is from Annie Dillard. In this passage, she uses the male pronoun for God, but it's not your traditional understanding of God. And she evokes in this Jesus' birth in the stable. She pictures God as our baby to bear and to hold and to care for. So she talks in this passage about faith, about her faith. I would consider it a process theology faith. Faith would be that God is self-limited utterly by his creation, a contraction of the scope of his will, that he bound himself to times and its hazards and haps as a man would lash himself to a tree for love. Faith, that God's works are as good as we make them, that God is helpless, our baby to bear, self-burdened at the doorstep of time, wondered at by cattle and oxen.